Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 4th of January. Every now and then, I imagine myself, actually it happens quite often because we do a number of history programs with wonderful guests, and you feel like you're sitting in a college taking a class from a wonderful historian, and that's what's going to happen this hour. And the focus of the lecture will be on Abigail and John Adams, and we are going to hear a discussion of their lives from a wonderful historian, Joseph Ellis, who won the Pulitzer Prize for Founding Brothers. His portrait of Thomas Jefferson, American Sphinx, won the National Book Award, and we've had him on several times. He's written a number of books. I mentioned some of those before the news: Triumphs and Tragedies at the Founding of the Republic, American Creation, the name of that, His Excellency George Washington, Founding Brothers, The Revolutionary Generation, Passionate Sage, The Character and Legacy of John Adams, and many other books. He is the Ford Foundation Professor of History at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts, and he says that in the preface to the book, his interest in the Adams family began 20 years ago when he wrote a book about John Adams in retirement, eventually published as Passionate Sage. And he had a sense that he was stepping into a long-standing conversation between Abigail and John in its final phase. He had an equivalently clear sense that the conversation preserved in the roughly 1,200 letters between them constituted a treasure trove of unexpected intimacy and candor, more revealing than any other correspondence between a prominent American husband and wife in American history. And it will probably remain so forevermore because people don't write many letters anymore, right? It's a fascinating story, and it's a love story, as he said, not only a love story, but the birth of America all in one, and it just doesn't get much better than that. We welcome phone calls. We'll chat for a while with Joseph Ellis and then take some of your calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Joseph Ellis, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. It's really great to be back with you.
Oh, it's great to have you here. You know, there are so many what-ifs in our own lives and in history, but I was thinking as I was reading about their courtship, what if he had really hit it off with Abigail's sister, Hannah? It would have been a whole different thing, right?
But when they first meet, it's in the parlor of Abigail's father's house. He's a minister in Weymouth, Mass., and John goes back and writes in his diary, says, very uninteresting woman, has no opinions, can't talk. And it seems like, it obviously was not a love at first sight. And obviously Abigail, who's one of the most opinionated and independent ladies you could ever meet, wasn't behaving in accord with her real personality. But pretty soon after that, they started seeing each other, and they recognized in one another a natural match. It was really not love at first sight, love at second sight. And the courtship goes on for 5 years. And the first edition of the letters in the courtship in the 19th century by their grandson, Charles Francis Adams, was censored and expurgated because it contained too many explicit sexual
oh my goodness.
References that the Victorians found somewhat disdainful.
Oh, and it was. It really paints a full. You were looking at a love story, I think, as you said, in addition to this incredible story about the birth of the nation. But there was a love story with all of its wonderful attachment,
yeah,
and physical attachment.
I mean, I didn't know, Kathleen, when I first started writing this, I thought I was writing basically a history that was the story of the founding of the Republic as seen through the eyes of two prominent players. And about halfway through, I realized that's not what I was doing at all. I was telling a love story being lived across the landscape of that important historical moment. And it was a different kind of book for me because as a historian and biographer, my strength usually is the fact that I am reasonably well read in the sources, the documents and the letters and of the founders and the key political evidence. Here, you really need to draw on your own life and your own experience of love over different seasons, as it changes its character and coloration, over the difficulty of raising children, of aging, of what resilience means, what unconditional commitment means. And those aren't things you're going to find in historical documents. You're going to find them inside yourself. And the book helped me to think about my own life and my own ability to sustain love, or I hope my wife's ability to do the same thing. And I dedicated the book to her. Her name is Ellen. And I said to Ellen, my Abigail. And she liked that.
I'll bet she liked that. That's a Merry Christmas present forever, right? Just keep giving her a copy of the book forevermore. The other thing is love sustained through really, really long separation.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the ironies and paradoxes of it all is that we have so many of the letters between them because they were apart so often. And, you know, like Dolly and James Madison probably could have had a similar correspondence, though I don't think so. But they're always together. And Martha and George Washington, they had a substantial correspondence, but Martha burned them all at George's request in his will. So that the distance between them, whether it was from Braintree to Philadelphia or from Braintree to Paris, really is one of the reasons we know so much about them.
Mm-hmm.
And she... especially when John was gone to Europe, Paris, and then Amsterdam from 1780 to 1784, I think that Abigail was almost clinically depressed, living by herself. Well, she had three of the four kids with her, and John Quincy went with his father across the ocean. And that's a chapter in the marriage where things almost fall apart. She's so depressed, and I must say he is not as good a correspondent at that time as he should have been. He's busy, to be sure, eventually negotiating the end of the American Revolution. And it's also the fact that it took 6 months for a letter to get from Boston to Paris, or back, and so you couldn't really sustain anything like a conversation. It was just too much time. And by the time you receive a letter, the issues being discussed have already happened and moved on to a new chapter.
Goodness, if they had had emails, you would have been looking at hundreds of thousands of pages,
yeah.
Right?
I think psychologically it's a different world
yes.
than the one that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
We're accustomed to a level of interactive, immediate communication that has enormous value, but it also lacks what these letters have in the form of deliberateness, deliberation, that is, and a kind of constructed thought process. Letter writing in the 18th century was a different act than writing an email.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend some time talking about her. I find her just a fascinating person. As you write, she was a dutiful wife, but very much an intellectual equal. And she read all the time and learned
right.
French. She was self-taught, but she was really smart, wasn't she?
She was. I mean... It's unusual that in that time that a man would want to be married to a woman like Abigail because she was saucy, as he called her, and quite independent. And it speaks well of John that he was not only willing but sort of thrilled to be able to live a life with this woman who was an intellectual and psychological equal. In fact, I think her letters are better than his. And I'm not the only scholar that's read them that has reached that conclusion. They're a little bit more literary than his, have more literary references. And Abigail was not formally educated. She was what we would call homeschooled by her father, who was a Harvard graduate, and her grandmother, who was a Quincy, one of the major figures in New England. But you can see she's very well read in the British classics, mostly, and she, you know, her favorite author is Shakespeare, and she's and when anything would happen, like when John would write a political pamphlet in the 1760s or 70s, or when he wrote the Massachusetts Constitution in 1779, he did single-handedly, by the way, in 2 weeks.
Goodness.
Every night, he would sit down and read it out loud to her. And she would tell him what she thought of it. So that this is a real partnership here. And I don't think that when they get to the presidency, I don't think that any woman, what we will call first lady later, has a comparable influence on policy until you get to Eleanor Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
So Abigail was a force. She was tough. And at times, some of the things she had to say as a mother will probably send some people a spinning. because when John Quincy arrived safely in France after a difficult voyage with his father across the North Atlantic in the winter, she says to him, she writes to him and says, that I'm so glad that you made it, but if in fact you turn out to live an immoral life, I would prefer that you've gone to the bottom right now.
Oh!
Yeah.
Wow. The other thing that's, well, so much about the book is striking to me, but what she was seeing really firsthand, she and John Quincy looking at a famous battle in the Revolutionary War. But
battle
the war,
of Bunker Hill, yeah.
It was right next door.
Yeah, they live in Braintree, which is about 5 miles from Boston, but they go up on a hill, Penn's Hill, and watch from a distance as the Battle of Bunker Hill proceeds. And their family physician, called Joseph Warren, is killed in the battle. He's the first American martyr. The British desecrate his body and cut his head off. You know, John Quincy, later in his life, after he's president and then goes back to being a member of the House of Representatives, is asked to come to the dedication of the Bunker Hill Monument. This is, I think, 1843. And the president of the United States is there, Tyler, and Tyler's a slave owner, and he's got a slave holding an umbrella over him for to block the sun. And John Quincy makes notes in his diary right there at the spot and said, if my mother and father had been able to see this, they would have regarded it as a desecration of the very values that those men, brave men, died for. He, you know, by that time, he's really pretty much a staunch anti-slavery, not quite an abolitionist, but that's his big cause.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about John's ego for a moment. Did his ambitions get the best of him at times? And did he sacrifice?
He is a very ambitious man. Not ambitious to make money.
No.
Not ambitious to be materially successful, but ambitious to achieve fame. That is, fame is more than just success in this lifetime. Fame is eternal. Fame is a form of secular immortality, and that means that you have to achieve something not just in the private sector but in the public realm. You have to achieve something, and of course he's born into a moment that gives him an opportunity to do that that's unprecedented. I think that John wasn't sure whether there was a heaven in any traditional Christian sense of the term. He once said, if it can ever be shown that there is no hereafter, my advice to every man, woman, and child on the planet is to take opium.
remember that.
But for him, achieving secular immortality and fame, living on in the memories of subsequent generations and in the history books, that was his goal, and he was very ambitious about that. And that ambition caused problems for the family because that meant that he was away a lot and that he would make choices that were clearly driven by his own desire to excel in the public realm and not to be a present husband and father. And on many occasions, Abigail was hoping that he would choose otherwise,
mm-hmm.
including run for the presidency.
Yeah, except he was born into that moment, and what a moment that was.
Well, he's born into a moment that permits him to seriously consider defining
yes.
the first American republic.
I know, isn't that something?
Yeah.
You asked the question at one point, and let's talk about the children here for a moment. Did the absence of their father, and it was pretty extreme absence, stunt the children's emotional growth?
I think that, I'm not sure I'd put it quite that way, but I think that both Abigail and John worried about this, so I'm not just making it up.
You know,
they talk about it. And I think the way Abigail put it was that that because John wasn't a palpable presence in their lives during their formative stage in many instances, he was for John Quincy, by the way, and he took him with him both times he went to Europe as a very young boy. They had an image of their father that was almost otherworldly. They thought of him almost mythically, and it was almost impossible for any of them ever to match what he did. So that if they got to see him on a day-by-day basis, the way our kids see us and watch us bumble around the house and not know how to take the trash out, they would have had a more realistic sense of what fatherhood meant. But I think John Quincy, of course, is a huge success.
I'd say so.
President of the United States.
Right.
But more than that, one of probably the greatest statesmen in the years between the Revolutionary Generation and Lincoln. I mean, when John Quincy is probably the best read president ever to be elected. When John Quincy was being considered for the ministry to become American minister to St. Petersburg, in the debate in the Senate, there was sort of a moment saying, "Well, you know, he's the son of what was then the current vice president, and that might be a problem." And someone got up and said, "Well, is there anybody else who's fluent in Latin, Greek, French, Dutch, Russian, and German?"
Goodness.
I mean, and he was.
Yeah.
But he was not a happy man. And in some ways, he never had a childhood. And the younger boy, Charles, died as an alcoholic at age 30. The youngest son, Tommy, lived a kind of dissipated life. He could produce children, but that was about it. And he became an alcoholic, too. The daughter, Nabby, Abigail II, called Nabby, who was the eldest child, married badly and had a very unhappy life and then died of breast cancer in her father's arms back in Quincy. So it's a kind of dysfunctional family.
Yes.
And
the
center of it are Abigail and John, who, you know, are just, you know, they're never going to go down. I mean, it's not a sentimental story. And it's also the reason why it's a love story for adults. You know, this is like Romeo and Juliet grown up.
Hmm.
And it's got, I mean, when they asked Abigail once if she would ever do it again, that is, marry John, she said, of course, I could not imagine suffering so much with anyone else.
Oh.
So, you know, life is not just a sentimental story. And it's a tough struggle on occasion. And and love, as I say, means making it through very difficult patches.
Yeah. I was interested in the letters and the educational advice that John was giving his children when you talked about how well-read in all the languages John Quincy spoke. His father recommended that he read certain things, didn't he?
Right. I mean, he, you know, always had something to offer. Like he said, you know, well, during the latter stages of the American Revolution, read Tacitus. That'll tell you what's going to happen to the British Empire. Said, I want you to be able to read it in Latin, but until you can master Latin, you might as well get an English translation.
Oh my goodness!
And money of his, you know, much of his educational advice, his reading advice, had to do with what we would call the classics. But he would also say, he one time said to John Quincy, "Don't just read serious books; read poetry. always have a poet in your pocket," and so that. But there was a level of pressure on John Quincy to excel that was extraordinary, and it paid. It took a toll on the man, in some sense, who as an adult had a difficult time with his own children, one of whom committed suicide, and with being a sociable person. When he was ambassador in Russia, in St. Petersburg, the British ambassador there said, he sat among us as a bulldog sits amongst spaniels. He was just a tough guy. And that was good and that was bad.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. I love the advice of always have a poem in your pocket. That would be good advice. They don't do that for 2011. Our guest this hour is Joseph Ellis, who has written yet another wonderful book, this one on Abigail and John Adams. It is titled First Family, and Joseph Ellis read all of the letters between them, over 1,200 letters, and realized that he had two remarkable stories here. One, a love story, and as he just described it, a love story for adults, because it was filled with a great deal of sadness, losing members of their family and alcoholism in the family and great separation, well, to say nothing of the war that was going on right almost outside the door of Abigail Adams. It's a really compelling story. So it's a love story, but it's also, and there's a great deal about the founding of the country in his latest book. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We also have an email address which you can use in case you would prefer not to use the phone. I don't know why I would like to talk to you, but if you can't use the phone, then try the email, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joseph Ellis, our guest, and the book is First Family, Abigail and John Adams. Let's start our calls with Aaron from Whitefish Bay. Hi, Aaron.
Yes, I wanted to ask your guest why was there an animosity between Franklin and John Adams, and John Adams and Jefferson? Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Aaron.
Good question. There was an animosity between Adams and both Franklin and Jefferson. With Jefferson, he patched it up at the end of his life, and they had a remarkable correspondence and recovered their friendship in 155 letters. And then, you couldn't make this up, both died on the same day, which was actually July 4th. 50th anniversary of the Declaration. Franklin was the kind of man put on earth by God to drive a man like Adams nuts. Franklin was the most famous American of his time, even more famous than Washington in Europe, because of his achievements as a scientist. There was a temperamental difference between the two men. Adams was much more conspicuously ambitious and energetic, and Franklin was dry and droll. They worked together early on in the Revolution very closely, and then they were sent by the Continental Congress to parley with Lord Howe on Staten Island to see if the war could be stopped, and it couldn't. But they had to stay in a rooming house in New Brunswick on the way and sleep in the same bed, and they end up having an argument that starts their breakup about whether the window should be open or closed. Franklin claiming that if you open it up, it gives you circulation. Adams saying no. And when Franklin died, Adams said he died because he caught a cold because he left the window open. And Adams says going to heaven for him meant not the beatific vision, gazing upon God, but thinking about making love with Abigail and arguing with Franklin. So it is an intrigue. And when they're in Paris together, Adams is up at 5 o'clock to do the work, and Franklin hasn't even gotten back from the parties that night. And all these people come to see him and worship him, and it makes Adams sick, who's jealous and envious and irritable about it. If you ever see the HBO series on John Adams, which is very well done indeed.
Yes, it is.
Notice the character who plays Jefferson, and Jefferson is not as attractive a figure as most people might have imagined there, and that's the view of Jefferson that Adams had, too.
I love this description, because it's funny to think of Franklin this way when you talk about his approach to diplomacy, American diplomacy in Paris. He had a lap-oriented approach to American diplomacy.
That's, yeah, Adam said that. Women would come sit on his lap in these salons. And it, sometimes it sounds like a dirty old man, but Adam said, no, it's all harmless. And at least at that stage, he says that. And Franklin is, I mean, if you were to say of all the founders, Franklin's probably the wisest. Adams is the best read and I think the most candid. But if you want to bring them all back, I'd bring those two back before anybody else.
Let's go next to Edie from Marshfield. Hi, Edie.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you doing today?
Fine. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you for this topic. I mean, I have a comment and a question. My comment is, growing up in Africa, reading about the Revolutionary War, I always looked at these three men, Washington, Jefferson, and Adams, as the driving force behind the, behind this country's formation. And when I go to D.C. and I see Washington Monument and Jefferson Monument, and there's nothing about John Adams, it just makes me mad.
Me too.
Because this guy was, I think, the principal guy behind this country's formation. There's nothing in his honor in D.C.
Why isn't there one?
Well, I testified with David McCulloch before a subcommittee of Congress a couple of years ago.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, to initiate a memorial for Washington, for Adams, you know, on the Mall. And I said, you know, it was 100 years overdue, so I agree with the caller on this. And if you brought the whole revolutionary generation back and that you described who's on the Mall and who isn't, they would be shocked. And because Adams was generally regarded as, next to Washington, the single most important and influential figure in the making of the American Revolution. I proposed a monument of Abigail and John with John Quincy trailing behind.
Oh, nice. I like
feeling,
that.
Feeling that that might appeal to the family values people.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the congressmen, I think he's still there, said that he would not approve any new monument on the Mall until Ronald Reagan had the biggest monument.
Oh.
And so I thought, well, we're never... There is now a movement, I think it's passed, it's going to happen, for an Adams statue that will appear close to the White House, not on the Mall, but close to the White House.
Thanks, Edie, so much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Well, it's almost as though we go in waves in this country. I don't remember spending a whole lot of time when I was in college, which, mind you, was a while ago, studying Adams. It's as though his time has finally come.
It has. I think you're absolutely right. He wasn't listed as, you know, among the top tier for many years. I think that there are a couple reasons for the growth in the Adams reputation. One is the publication of the correspondence, which is, I think, the richest correspondence of all the founders' correspondence, and so revealing about both public events and private events. And secondly, and this is my hobby horse that you can take or leave, but I think Adams is so conspicuously flawed that he can't be iconic. He can't keep his mouth shut. He lacked what he called the gift of silence.
Mm.
And we are only now beginning to want to have our founders flawed.
Mm.
We want people, I mean, if they were perfect, what in heaven's name would we learn from them,
right,
since none of us is perfect? But it also begins to recover the sense of the American Revolution, not as a series of, you know, great men who float above it all, but the improvisational character of the Revolution, that they were making it up as they went along, and that and none of them was perfect. And Adams is the most conspicuously imperfect, but also, I think, the most lovable.
Mm-hmm. He is. There is something very lovable about him.
Well, because he knows, he confronts his own demons. In other words, yes, he's ambitious, but he knows that. Yes, he's vain, and he knows that and talks about it and
mm-hmm.
chides himself
mm-hmm.
for it. So that, you know, it's, and yet what you said at the start, Kathleen, we know more about him than we'll ever know about Barack Obama or George W. Bush. I mean, he's given us an insight into not just his mind, but his soul in a way that is extraordinarily precious.
Mm. Oh, yes, how true. All right, Marty from Green Bay. Hi, Marty.
Hello.
Yes, Marty, hi.
If I may, I'd like to ask your guest if he can contrast the concept of democracy Adams had with what our popular concept is today.
Well, there's a good big question
big
for
question.
You. Yeah.
Adams would not have used the word democracy in a positive sense. Most of the founders wouldn't. They didn't think they were establishing a democracy. They thought they were establishing a republic. Res publica, things of the public. And the public interest is different from the popular interest at any given time. And Adams is especially clear about this, namely that the people are often misled and often don't see the long-term interest of the society. That is the public interest, the long-term interest. So if you're a public official, an elected official, or a president, your job is not to listen to polls, not to do what is at the moment the right thing to do for votes, but to divine what's in the best interest of the nation. And so if Adams had chosen to go to war with France in 1798 when he's president, he would have been reelected. He chose not to do it, wisely so, because it was an unnecessary war, and he lost the election. He then said, that's even more proof that I did the right thing.
Hmm.
At times, Adams is perverse. He thinks that if you do the popular thing, it must always be wrong. And remember, he starts his career publicly by defending the British troops in the Boston Massacre. So that he is a pre-democratic figure, meaning the emergence of a truly democratic politics in the early 19th century is something that he regards as a decline.
Let's talk for just a moment about his thoughts concerning a republic. Did these formulate and stew in his mind for some time, or was there an incident or a couple incidents that made him think, we got to break off from the British?
No, he's very early to the game. About 1765, a full 10 years before it becomes a serious possibility, Adams believes that it's inevitable that the American colonies are going to break with the British Empire. And Abigail does, too. They start their life together in 1764 at the same time as this whole crisis is beginning. And so their whole lives are lived along the same political axis. But Adams is, again, very well read in the history of republics and the rise and fall of empires, and is writing pamphlets. And you know, he writes hundreds of pamphlets in the 1760s and 70s that are constitutional arguments. She's a little bit more operatic about it as Abigail. I mean, for her, it's the forces of light against the forces of darkness, and we're the forces of light. So they are ahead of public opinion and waiting for the American people to catch up with them.
Hmm.
And eventually they do in the summer of 76.
Mm-hmm. And at what point, they must have had concerns about the might of the British Army. At what point does John realize, or Abigail first, whatever the case may be, that the British Army is not invincible?
They never think it's invincible because they think that the British are not just fighting the Continental Army. The British have to subjugate the American people, and that is impossible.
Hmm.
And when the American Army in New York is defeated in a humiliating way in the August of 76, it looks like maybe Washington's entire army might be annihilated, Abigail says, doesn't make any difference, we'll just raise another army. And if necessary, an army of Amazons. So that there is a kind of invincibility to their conviction. And even when there's a defeat, like when General Howe's army occupies Philadelphia, John says, well, that'll just be a bigger problem for them because they won't be able to control the population. I mean, as I was writing some of these pages, I must say, I hope I don't offend anybody out there, but that I was thinking of what would John and Abigail say about America's presence in Afghanistan. And I mean, I really do think that that the British cause was hopeless once you understand it the way the Adamses did, and I feel similar about our own in Afghanistan.
Hmm. You can say whatever you want. It's your hour. And you're an eminent historian.
Well,
yeah,
I don't know what eminent means, but I've been doing it for a while.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to an email here. Please talk more about John Adams' ancestry. I know he came from England. Who first came to this country, and was he a Puritan?
He is a kind of secularized Puritan. He's from a very venerable, in terms of his the original Adams comes to New England in 1635 or 36. So it's right there at the beginning of the founding of Massachusetts Bay Colony. It's not a particularly wealthy family or prominent family. His father is a farmer and a shoemaker. When he is graduating from Harvard in 1754, 55, the class rank at Harvard at that time, pre-revolution, wasn't based on your academic rate, your academic performance. It was based on your social
standing. Yes, I didn't know that.
And he was in the sort of just below the middle. So he didn't come from a family that was as prominent, for example, as Abigail's family, which was the Quincy side of things, was very prominent. In fact, Abigail's, I think, grandmother, maybe mother, didn't want her to marry John because she thought she would be marrying down. But John is the first of his family to ever to go to college. And so he becomes a member of the American intellectual elite, but he's not anything like an aristocrat.
Mm. But he actually, what, graduated fourth in that class? Or
second.
Second in the class.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, he was the second leading scholar in his class. John Quincy, of course, when he gets there, he becomes the first. And John was proud of him for besting him.
We welcome more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Joseph Ellis. His latest book is First Family, Abigail and John Adams. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We've been getting a few emails here, too. I'll get to some of those. And that is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, Jill in Viroqua. Hi.
Hello, good morning, Mr. Ellis. My question for you is concerning Abigail's relationship with other women when John was gone for so long. Was there any support for her with friends that were her own age and maybe not related to her? But I think you spoke a little bit about that in your book and that relationship, the one. There was a break in that when they had some kind of an argument or over something. Can you tell a little bit more about that?
Yes. When John's gone, the closest female friends she has are her sisters, both of whom live close by. And she writes a lot of letters to them. I mean, they're part of the correspondence. Her closest female friend outside the family was Mercy Otis Warren, who is herself a very prominent lady living in Plymouth, Mass., about 15 or 20 miles away from Quincy Braintree. And Mercy Otis Warren was wrote plays during the Revolution anonymously that were, you know, moralistic, pro-American patriotic plays. And then she wrote a three-volume history of the American Revolution in the early 19th century. There was a falling out between them because she had hoped that John, when he was president, would give their son a job and or a sinecure, and he refused to do it, and that caused some bad blood. And then when she wrote this history I mentioned, John didn't think that she gave him the sufficiently prominent role that he thought she deserved, or he thought he deserved. And but eventually they patched things up just before Mercy died, and I think that if you think about Mercy Otis Warren and Abigail Adams, there's two of the single most forceful, intellectually significant women in revolutionary America.
Here's an email from Jeanette. After reading at least five different books on Adams, I came to the conclusion that our Hubert Humphrey comes closest to Adams' love of words. What say you?
I would never think of calling Adams the happy warrior, and there is I think that Hubert Humphrey, as I knew him as a as a young man, as he was vice president, was more. They both were garrulous. They both talked a lot. They both liked to speak on their feet. And though I think that Adams is more volcanic, Adams is like a series of verbal eruptions. And I think that Hubert Humphrey was a more controlled person. And so that I, temperamentally, they're coming from a very different place altogether.
Cindy is next from Paoli. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, thank you. I have two questions I'd like to ask. First, is there any truth to the idea that was first popularized in the Broadway musical 1776 that Abigail organized the women around Braintree to produce saltpeter for the manufacture of gunpowder at John's request?
That's true. She played a role. She wasn't the major organizer, but she did do that. That was based on actual historical evidence. It wasn't a fiction.
Interesting. Thank you. And my second question, could you please tell us about the story of Abigail taking it upon herself to go forward with smallpox inoculation for her children?
Good question. Yeah, in the summer of 76, there's a smallpox epidemic that's been sweeping through the Boston area. It's been there for a year. There are over 1,500 deaths over the preceding year. So smallpox, if caught in what they call the natural way, was fatal in about 60% of the cases. They had come up with inoculation. John had himself been inoculated earlier, early in his marriage, but they didn't. But inoculation was a bit dangerous. There was about a 5% mortality rate. And Abigail delayed it until she could do it with the kids. And John is down in Philadelphia, and she's back up in Braintree. And so all this is happening while the Declaration of Independence is being brought forward and the British Army is invading New York. But John's mind is as much on Abigail and the kids because he's worried about the inoculation process. And she writes him a lot of letters during this time. And one of the kids, Charlie, the younger son, catches it in what they call the natural way and almost dies. And Abigail describes Nabby as having over 1,000 pustules the size of green peas. Mm. She cannot lie down or stand up. So it's a difficult process going on while they're apart, and it really dramatizes the extent to which big public events like the Declaration and very powerful private personal events are occurring simultaneously in their lives.
Mm-hmm. And they're these huge events. We're not talking small things.
It's like the Big Bang in American history, and we're still living out the radiation implications of it all. And they're framing the republic in which we continue to live. And
right.
So it's a love story being lived across the landscape of what is undoubtedly the most politically significant era in American history.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Cindy. We go to Bob next from Waukesha. Hi, Bob.
Hey, good morning, Kathleen. Sorry about the voice. I had a quick question about the Sedition Act passed when Adams was the president. I wondered if Professor Ellis could reconcile that somehow with Adams being such a strong supporter of independence and the Sedition Act seemingly limiting First Amendment rights.
Yeah, it's the biggest mistake of Adams' presidency, and Adams knew it shortly thereafter. The Sedition Act allowed the government to throw newspaper editors and writers in jail for libelous charges against any public official. It is an interesting piece of legislation in one liberal sense. It's the first time in Anglo-American law that truth becomes a defense. That is, it's a funny thing because one New Jersey editor of something called The Wasp, said that John Adams had a big backside. And Abigail said, well, we can't throw him in jail because it's true. I think it's also interesting that in all their collaboration, Abigail almost always offers John excellent political advice. This is one case where she fails him. I'm not sure he would have signed the Sedition Act if it weren't for Abigail's strong support for it. She was like a lion protecting her lair, and these attacks on her husband that really were pretty potent, and some of them quite libelous indeed, in the press. The partisan press then is just as bad as the blogosphere now. But she urged him to sign it, and then he lived to regret that, and he said that later on. And if you would bring him back now, or bring both of them back now, they both would tell us that the Patriot Act was a mistake.
Mm. Thanks, Bob. John in Milwaukee, hi.
I had two questions. One would be, if he was a politician today, do you think he would lean more towards being a Republican or a Democrat? And then my second question was he ever in a position to own slaves, and what would it been his position on slavery?
I'll take the second first. No, he never owned a slave. He opposed slavery. He thought slavery was fundamentally a contradiction of the American Revolution, though he thought that the only way to end it would be to do so gradually. And he actually believed he would die a natural death because he didn't believe that slave labor could compete with free labor. He did not foresee the cotton gin. And when he lived long enough to see that if slavery was going to expand, he was very, very worried and upset, and he told John Quincy that his lifetime mission was going to be to help end slavery. On the first one, it's really tough to make comparisons between then and now on party terms. I think that John is a political conservative and believes in a Burkean sense of the term conservative. Gradual change is better than rapid change. On the other hand, he was a radical on the issue of independence. I don't think he'd fit comfortably in either political party now. And he's, in the end, a person who can't be a member of a party. He's the kind of president that would have to be elected without a party, which is impossible these days, and would say that the president's main job is to defy these partisan positions and to do what's best for the country and serve one term and then go away.
Hmm. Didn't Abigail have a slave that went with her into the marriage?
She had that's her father owned two slaves, and one of them, freed, came with her and then stayed on and became a member of the household. And when Abigail went abroad in 1784, she left control of the household in that former slave's hands.
Hmm. Thanks, John, for the call. Here's an email. What was John's relationship with Franklin, Jefferson, Livingston, and Sherman during the writing of the Declaration of Independence? How much of 1776 is fable?
Well, the true thing about 1776 is that, and I remember I went to talk to the actors when they put on a performance at the theater in Minneapolis, and the true thing is that Adams was the major figure in the Second Continental Congress, pushing the delegates towards independence, often kicking and dragging them forward. The committee that the writer refers to is the five-person committee designated to draft the Declaration. Interestingly, it wasn't regarded as a rather important task then. Other bigger things were going on, they thought. John was the chair of the committee, an unofficial chair, and he first offered the opportunity to draft the Declaration to Franklin, whom he said was the finest prose stylist in America. Franklin refused, saying he would never write a document that would be edited by a committee.
Oh.
And so he then offered it to Jefferson, who was regarded as the sort of silent penman of the Revolution. He used to draft things for committees behind the scenes, but never participated in the debate. They asked Adams later why he didn't do it, and he said, because I had made myself obnoxious. They had been so vociferous in pushing for independence, he had made enemies, and he didn't want the document to be in any way contaminated by that. He lived on, of course, he rued the day he didn't draft it himself, because this becomes Jefferson's primary ticket into the American pantheon.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was an accidental choice of Jefferson, but in the end, an extraordinarily prescient one.
Hmm. We have about a minute left. Let's go to Matthew from Elgin, Illinois. Hi, Matthew.
Hi. Sorry. That's okay. My understanding was Washington was drawn into it. He was not part of the leadership of the Revolution, but to enlist the monetary support of the South.
That's not quite right. Washington is committed to the Revolution early on, not as quickly as Adams, but he's elected to the Continental Congress and becomes a significant player once it becomes clear that this might very well become a military conflict. He's the only member of the Continental Congress to wear a military uniform, and John nominates him, and he's elected in June 15, 1775, to head what becomes the Continental Army. So he's early to the game. It is true that one of the reasons Adams names him is because he's a Virginian, and he needs, it's not monetary, but political support. You got to, the war's going on up in New England and Massachusetts. You need to assure that Virginia, the biggest colony, the largest population, is behind this, and Washington assures that.
Thank you very much, Matthew, for the call. Oh, Joseph, I hate to let you go. Thank you so much for writing the book and for being with us this hour.
It's been my pleasure. You guys are great out there, and give Madison a big hug.
Okay, we will. Thank you.
Take care.
Our guest this hour, Joseph Ellis. The book is First Family, Abigail and John Adams. He's written extensively a number of books about the Founding Fathers. He won the Pulitzer Prize for Founding Brothers, and his portrait of Thomas Jefferson, American Sphinx, won the National Book Award. He's the Ford Foundation Professor of History at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. So that was an interesting hour, wasn't it? I love those history shows. Thanks to Chrissy Pease and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks for all of your calls. We'll be with you again tomorrow.